Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
The concern for purity was the cornerstone of the religious culture of ancient Judaism, shaping the worldview of Jewish people during the Second Temple period, as well as their daily practices and social relations. In his book, Purity and Identity in Ancient Judaism, Yair Furstenberg examines how different groups offered competing visions and methods for living a life of purity, which embodied a promise of personal and cosmic salvation, and at the same time determined the degree of sectarian separation. Join us as we speak with Yair Furstenberg about his recent book, Purity and Identity in Ancient Judaism. You're listening to New Books in Jewish Studies, a channel of the New Books Network, and I'm your host, Michael Morales. Yair Furstenberg is associate professor and chair of the Department of Talmud at Hebrew University. He's also published Jewish Martyrdom and Antiquity from the Book of Maccabees to the Babylonian Talmud. Yair, welcome to New Books in Jewish Studies.
Thank you very much. I'm so glad to be here.
Could you tell us about yourself and how you got interested in studying purity in ancient Judaism?
Yeah, thanks for the question. I could say that I'm a scholar of Jewish law. That's my main field of expertise. From the beginning of my studies as a scholar of rabbinic literature, I was mostly interested in early Jewish law at the stages that it was beginning to develop as a system. And I was always interested in the gap between biblical law and rabbinic law. Those we have like hundreds of years between these two literary bodies, and substantial developments took place. And I'm personally also a observant Jew. That means that Jewish law is something that is a daily issue, and the questions of development of law and the transformation and what powers impact and influence the shaping of daily practice of Jews was something that always interests me on an existential level, I must say. But in university studies, I was, after studying rabbinic literature and classics in my early stages in my university studies, I chose the issue of purity mainly because it's considered the most complicated legal issue in rabbinic literature. I mean, even if you only open Leviticus, you see that it's quite complicated questions of purity and impurity and bodily situations of this case or not. But when you arrive to rabbinic literature, it becomes like immense body of laws. It's very, very detailed. And you ask yourself, how did this issue develop in such a way? And did it reflect any real existence or way of life, or is it all like theoretical discussions, a very, very detailed discussion? And I was really concerned from this gap between biblical law and rabbinic law. But the problem is, and I must say that this field is also very interesting because today, I mean, this was the biggest portion of Jewish law in antiquity. We can see that from just from the size of the books discussing this field. It's the largest portion of law in both in rabbinic law and also in other sources that I'll mention soon. But immediately after the Talmudic period, at about the 5th, 6th, 7th century, it stopped being a significant issue at all. I mean, a whole complete issues of being careful what you touch, what you eat, who you come in contact with, all these issues have ceased to be relevant to practical Jewish law. Only in the field of only in the specific issue of menstrual impurity, so sexual relationships between a husband and a wife during the woman's period is still relevant. So you see a field that is significantly changed. There was a some period that it became a very substantial issue, and then it faded away. And now it's very curious to ask what makes that feel so. What made that feel so significant? So my main question was, my main concern was, what happened in the hundreds of years between the Hebrew Bible and rabbinic literature at about the 2nd, 3rd century that made such a difference? So I started working from a very, I would say, from my perspective now, from quite a narrow perspective into the topic, just thinking internally from within this development of law. But then I realized, as I was digging back and trying to understand the sources, that actually you cannot study this field as only as a legal issue, and you cannot only use legal sources and rabbinic sources, and you cannot skip from studying the laws of purity in Leviticus or in other portions of the Hebrew Bible, and then go to rabbinic sources, the Mishnah, the Tosefta, the Talmuds in the 2nd, 3rd, 4th century, etc., and try to create the continuous story without understanding that purity is in fact a much larger issue, which is all-encompassing, as I'll describe, I think, later on. But more importantly, that actually it's not only legal, it's also ideological. Also, there are very aspects of moral issues of a purity and impurity that were very significant for in ancient Judaism, and social aspects, and that each of the literary sources that we have on Jewish society or various forms of Judaism in antiquity had their own perspective on purity. So suddenly purity becomes from a specific legal issue into a discourse, into a whole field that you have many voices, whether it's from the sectarians of Qumran, the Essenes, or whether it's early Christians in the New Testament and other early Christian sources, each of them presenting their own perspective of what it means to be pure. Pure is something that we all want to be, but each of us understands that in a different way. And it becomes so intense in such a way of defining each of the groups. So each of us holds one corner of it. And in order to understand the rabbinic literature, you have to understand what is it's responding to, what other voices it's responding to. So I found myself, I started as a scholar of rabbinic literature, and suddenly I found myself working on New Testament sources. I understood that I have no other choice but to be an expert on the Synoptic Gospels, which are a crucial source for understanding the concepts of purity. And I have to know much more about Qumran and sectarian Judaism and Second Temple Judaism. So what I and so it became an exciting like field that I expanded my own conception of Judaism in general and my own conception of of what it means to be a scholar of Jewish law. What that law is a mirror into much larger social, ideological elements within ancient Judaism.
Your book states that the concern for purity was the cornerstone of the religious culture of ancient Judaism. Would you explain or develop that idea for us?
Yeah, I believe in that strongly. And again, it's something that I found out only as I was working through this topic. And so just to give a brief background, purity is an important topic in the Hebrew Bible, in Leviticus, and mainly in the priestly code. But it's focused in its earlier manifestations, it's focused on the issue of what are the requirements in order to encounter the holy realm. If you want to go into the temple, or if you want to, or if you're in the space or the area of the tabernacle, if you want to eat sacrifice or holy foods, if you're a priest, so within the realm of God's presence, we can say it clearly this way, you have to be in a situation of purity. You cannot come from your daily activities with all the lower aspects of human condition and encounter the presence of God, the perfect presence of God, which represents the perfect life, the vitality of living. And then you come, and then you, and if you're impure, that means that you encountered some aspects of death, if it's corpse impurity or various bodily fluids that are abnormal, right? So you cannot, this contact has to be regulated in a sense that you have to purify, you have to prepare yourself. So it signifies the space of the holy realm. It signifies the nature of the contact with the holy realm. Now, so there, it's mainly what we would call ritual purity. We're concerned with ritual purity when coming in contact with God's presence in general. But it was added another layer that was added to it already in Leviticus and in other biblical sources. And Ezekiel is the element of what we would call moral purity. That means that God cannot dwell in the land in the land of Israel if the people are sinning, because the sin is like a disgusting substance that contaminates the land, and that is impossible for God to be there. We would say that light sins, daily things that people sin or happen, they could, there, the temple itself, the priestly practice can solve, but grave sins like murder or idolatry, etc., are such an abomination that God has to leave the land. He cannot dwell within that. So already it's a significant issue already in the Hebrew Bible. But again, it's always with relation to God's presence, and it's mainly I would say it's mainly a ritual issue. But then, for some reason, during Second Temple period, already from the beginning, when the exiles return, and we see that in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, we see that purity becomes a defining condition of the I would say the elect group, or the way you define yourselves in contrast to others. And there was a heightened concern among those returning from the exile, and we see it continuing on into Second Temple Judaism later, of clearly delineating the difference between themselves and others. Now, the problem is that though the distinctions are many times not very clear, many times even what we would think ethnic distinctions don't really work because it's so complicated, ethnic relationships. So what is the way to distinguish yourself from others? So then the language of purity becomes the category of self-definition. So the Judeans are pure, and the dwellers of the land that what's called Am Haaretz are impure. That's the way to define yourself. And again, because I would say your religious identity becomes a thing in itself, and it's not directly related to the temple, but you are defined through your purity. And then you suddenly see that being pure is something that is not only when you come in contact with the temple, and being pure is a trait, and it's valuable in any way, and it's the way you map your social world. So Judeans are pure in contrast to the impure Gentiles, or within now as the more sectarian Second Temple Judaism becomes, and that's a question that is beyond our discussion. I think, why did the sectarianism develop within the complicated cultural situation of Second Temple Judaism? But one thing we can say that each group defined itself through its own form of uniqueness and purity. That means, again, it's not a theoretical thing, it's a practical thing. What is my daily practice that distinguishes me from others? And to what degree is this distinction between pure and impure essential, or can we overcome it? That means that if we take extreme sectarians as the Qumran sectarians, their view is that by definition, it's very interesting. The main distinction in the world is not between the Jews and and Gentiles, it's between the pure and impure. That means that also other Judeans who would maybe consider themselves to be from the same tradition and also to be the people of Israel, but actually, if they do not live according to the standards of our practice, they're actually what we would call the sons of darkness. They're not the sons of light, and they're actually, by their ontological status, is identical to the Gentiles in some way. So suddenly the borderlines between groups are reestablished according to the language of purity and impurity. So the examples on the other hand would be the early Christians, which if we take if the first thing that I always say, the first thing that helped the followers of Jesus to expand their group affiliation beyond the limited borders of the Judean society is when they decided that to overcome the concept of Gentile impurity, to decide that everybody can be pure. And not only the Judeans, and therefore everybody is worthy of the Holy Spirit, because the power of the Holy Spirit is relevant also to people who are not Judeans. And that is the famous case of Peter's vision in Acts 10, when he gets the vision that God himself says, "I do not deem people as impure or defiled." That means that everybody is worthy. So the first thing you have to do when you decide what your group is, the way you vision eschatology, the way you vision the messianic age, the way you vision the right way of life, is to decide what is the definition of pure and who is included within that definition. So you see that purity is the overarching category that also determines your daily practice, who you're going to touch, who you're going to live with, right? Are you able to eat with someone or not eat with him? Is it pure and impure? Who your group will be? Who are the people that are keeping the same standards that like you are? Are you an Essene, an extreme sectarian, or are you a Pharisee that you care about purity, but you do it in a more I would say in a more open-minded way, and you're willing to be more flexible about the your relationship with other groups, or and then it also determines also space. When you walk in the streets of Jerusalem, it would have been clear if you're a Jew in the first century CE, walking in the streets of Jerusalem, it would be clear who are the people you can come in contact and who not, who you couldn't come in contact, depending on the side of this, what side of the sidewalk you would walk on, because it's that's we have sources describing that, because it was clear you can't touch anyone automatically. It's not something that you do without thinking, because you don't want to be defiled. So space is organized according to this kind of distinction, and also your expectations. What kind of world are we waiting for? When God will come and redeem the world, what does that mean? That God will transform the world and extract all of the impure substances within the world and change the nature of the world, change the nature of ourselves, our souls. There's a fantastic description in the one of the sources in Qumran, in the community rule, that it says, and one day at the end of the day, at the end of the all periods, when God will come and His Holy Spirit will dwell within our body members, within our bodies themselves, and take out all elements of impurity, and transform us, humanity, into a different kind of thing. So when we're thinking of what we're expecting, ultimately we all want to be pure. And that's why it's not surprising when you're aware of the dominance of purity as organizing both society and organizing your ideology. It's not surprising when you come to open the Mark, right, the beginning of Mark, and the first thing we learn that the story begins, or the story of Christianity begins, with John the Baptist, who is calling for purification. A very democratic, open, everybody's welcome to this act of purification, will ultimately bring the end of days. So you see, it's so suddenly you understand everything is connected. That's why I argue that that's the most important category, in all-embracing category within ancient Judaism, at least as long as we're talking about the Second Temple period.
So, what are some of the different approaches to purity among the varieties of Second Temple Judaism and their later offshoots?
Sure. It's easy to start from the most extreme positions, right? So I think my argument is that generally Palestinian Jews, we must I should mention that Jews living abroad, Jews living in the diaspora, usually did not use the language of purity as much as Palestinian Jews. So I am focusing on Jews living in Palestine during that period. And the way I understand the sources is that basically the notion that the distinction between pure and impure is the defining distinction between Judeans and others, right? So that's that general agreement. Until early Christians such as Peter come and undermine this assumption. Okay, so taking this take following this assumption, I would say that the most extreme of sectarians within Second Temple Judaism, what they did is apply the same distinction between Judeans and non-Judeans to the distinction between themselves and all others. And what they view, and those are the Josephus, when he describes the Essenes, says that if someone touches the someone that is not from the sect, touches the an Essene, he is it's as though he came in contact with Gentiles. So you see, for them, it's like a binary world. It's us us against the whole, all the rest, the rest of the world. And that means that there, in their view, the impurity is an essential a component of your identity. In a sense, it's not something that you can choose to be more pure or less pure. It's once you accept upon yourself the stringent way of life within the confines of the community, right? You are, it's actually like a divine transformation of yourself, right? And you're essentially a different kind of human person. And if you are, and if you're outside the sect, there's a very nice text. I mean, it's problematic ethically, right? But it's like one of the best expressions of the sectarian view is to is saying that if you do not, if you're not part of the sect, it does not matter how much you attempt to cleanse yourself in waters and sprinkle purification's water upon yourself and to sacrifice as much as purification sacrifice that you can, it will not help you. You're by definition, you're essentially impure. Because to be pure, that means to belong to the group of the elect, and that's something that is requires social affiliation that comes together with God's kind of intervention. So that's an extreme position. There are the priests in Jerusalem, let's say the temple priests, that view purity as centered in the temple itself. And they were very careful, and that's the thing they cared about, that when people come into the temple, that the distinction between the levels of purity will be very clear. So you have so it's so the so the, you can imagine the temple as a net, as a system of circles of different levels of purity. And you have in the temple itself, you have the priests who are the most pure, and then you have the Israelites who can only come to the space to the around the temple, and then you have impure Israelites that go into another external, more external space, and the Gentiles again cannot can stay in the holy mountain, not but not, and they would be very careful to maintain this kind of hierarchy, and so it would be very, very clear. And what we have, so there's a very famous we even have archaeological evidence for this very famous text that they would hang at the entrance of the temple, that no one who is not from who is not a Judean, anyone who is not a Judean cannot past this point. So you have very clear demarcations of the areas, but also inside the temple, we also have evidence for the distinction between the spaces becoming more and more clear. And that's a priestly ideal, that the distinction, that the hierarchy is something that is crucial for maintaining order. Maintaining the order, the spiritual order, maintaining social order, and that the temple has to represent this kind of ideal. Now, the rabbis testify to an alternative view, which comes to undermine this priestly approach. And according to the rabbis, who, according to my approach, and maybe I'll say something about my methodology in a moment, but according to my approach, the rabbis represent or continue the ideology of the Pharisees, of maybe the third most important group of within Second Temple Judaism, and the at least in the rabbinic presentation of the Pharisaic views, they present the time of gathering into the temple not as a time of a clear hierarchy, but exactly the opposite. The idea of they say that whenever you all people coming into Jerusalem, by definition, become all pure, even if they're not really pure, and we know that people cannot. But once you're part of this social connection, you become you're coming to Jerusalem in order to worship in the temple. We'll not check if you're pure. Even if we know that you're not really pure, we'll allow you in. We'll even allow you beyond the limits that are regularly allowed to non-priests. So it's like what the rabbis describe is the nightmare of the priest. What they're describing is people coming indiscriminately into the temple. We're aware of the fact that they probably have not purified as they should have, but the pilgrimage is more important than everything else. Everybody has to be together in the temple. So that's why times of festivals have become a moment of tension between this more hierarchical position and this more universal democratic position of the Pharisees. But the Pharisees, not only in festivals, but they really, their ideology was to promote purity practice even within the daily life, even among those who cannot isolate themselves in order to be pure. Because purity requires high level of isolation. You cannot come in contact with anyone. You see yourself as clearly distinct from others, right? You have the daily practices of impurity. So is there now, if we see that as a religious ideal, is it possible for the simple Judean, right, to somehow grasp, somehow participate in this kind of experience? So the Pharisees, while they themselves were very strict about purity, and that's the word Pharisee in Aramaic means parush, right? Separated. They separated themselves. So they did this establish their own status by viewing themselves as Pharisees, right? And the Pharisees' concern for purity is something that Jesus relates to a few times in the Gospels. But at the same time, when we analyze their exact policy, and that's something that you again, it's only it's everything is in the details. It's not enough to say they care about purity because everybody cares about purity. But when we analyze their legal policy, and that's exactly the kinds of work I can connecting the legal analysis of the details into the social situation, you suddenly realize that their whole ideology is trying to make a purity more accessible, more easy. You can experience purity even if you're not, right? If you're not a sectarian. For example, hand washing. Hand washing is something that famously Jesus attacks the Pharisees for promoting hand washing. So, and hand washing means that you can relatively easily prepare yourself, purify yourself before you eat your daily foods, and feel that you have pure, that you're pure. Now, there are various aspects to this innovation of the Pharisees, because this is it's not appeared in scripture. The ability, hand impurity is not something that the priest would do on a regular basis. So scholars have debated a lot. What's the idea behind this hand purity? My suggestion is that why do you purify your hands? You purify your hands before you eat, not something specifically before you eat, because you want to make sure that the food that you're digesting is pure. So actually, what you're really concerned about is not the purification of not the purity of the food itself, because we're talking about daily food. We're not talking about sacrifices. We're not talking about priestly foods. We're talking about daily foods. So why when I come home and I eat my supper, why should I wash my hands? Again, if we're using the language of purity, because I'm concerned about the purity of myself, right? So suddenly we see here that the focus of purity practices is not the temple, is not the separated elevation of this purity as a distinct way of life, but actually it's a possibility of feeling on a most personal individual level that you yourself can experience purity of yourself, of your body. You're guarding yourself as something that is keeping pure, and this reflects your some kind of higher religious maintenance of the self. So here is another completely different focus, and that has other implications. When the Pharisees, the most famous element of the Pharisees is the fact that they would eat their daily foods in purity. So suddenly, your daily life is something that is religiously significant. You can give it meaning. And that is very important, because what we see here, that there are groups during the Second Temple period already that have already created an alternative to the temple. So the Pharisees are not rejecting the temple, but actually what they're doing is they're creating a way of life which can give people that are not connected to the temple meaning and religious significance.
Well, what a fascinating discussion on purity. Yair, thank you for your work on purity in ancient Judaism and for joining us on the New Books Network.
Thank you. It was a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Friends, thank you for listening to New Books in Jewish Studies, a channel of the New Books Network. Goodbye.